Big stories, big guests, the big picture. Afternoons with Rob Breckenridge. Weekdays 12:30 to 3, 770 CHQR.
To modernize our continental defenses and to protect Canadians from new and emerging threats. This is the most significant upgrade to NORAD from a Canadian perspective in almost 4 decades.
Welcome aboard, folks. Big announcement today from Defense Minister Anita Anand. Canada is going to spend $4.9 billion over the next 6 years to help modernize North America's defense systems. And certainly, I think there are those who say, well, it's about time Canada steps up on continental defense. We want the benefits of this partnership with the Americans and the protection that NORAD provides. We need to be a reliable partner. There's some confusion, though, following the announcement as to whether this is actually new money that's been announced. As Global's Mercedes Stevenson has noted, that the speech today from the minister stated that this was new money. The minister's office has now said that $4.9 billion was already allocated for in the budget, and that the office will be issuing a correction. So some confusion there. Also, on the point about new and emerging threats, does that include missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles? Certainly could be a threat to North American security, but this is a part of that defense that Canada doesn't want to be a part of. We opted out of ballistic missile defense way back in 2005, and today Anand says Canada's position has not changed.
The reality is that we will continue to look at this policy going forward. We will engage in constant analysis of the policy to ensure that Canada has a proper response to missile threats across the board.
Well, joining us to talk about the future of NORAD, the future of bilateral cooperation on continental defense, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, Jim Ferguson, Deputy Director of the Center for Defense and Security Studies, Professor of the Department of Political Studies, University of Manitoba. Professor Ferguson, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, the fact that we're not even sure if this is new money being announced today, the whole announcement was maybe a little rushed or confusing. What do you make of that, first of all?
Well, it's an interesting point because I listened to the speech and the Q&A from the media afterwards, and she said it was new money. I was surprised that it was new money because the $8 billion addition to the defense budget in the 2022 budget, we have had no details on where it's going. So I expected this announcement would then explain that portion of that $8 billion, which would go to North American defense modernization. So when she said it was new, I was really surprised. And that's a lot of money, at least in my view. And then you raise questions about if $4.9 billion is new, going to NORAD or North American defense modernization, what's the other $8 billion besides the Ukrainian support? Where is that going? And I'm not surprised at all from Mercedes, reference and that the department's going to change this, that it's not new money. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
Interesting. So when we let's take a step back. When we talk about NORAD modernization and where this money is going, the government is going to spend, what is it we're talking about here?
Well, for the government, listening to the defense minister and as well as the chief of the defense staff and the deputy commander of NORAD, by and large, its focus is not surprising on northern approaches, renewing, modernizing, expanding, improving the North Warning System. Yet at the same time, they talk about the need to ensure that North American defense and cooperation with the United States is 360 degrees. Mm-hmm. So we're only interested in the northern part? Well, we have maritime approaches, and we need to cooperate more with the Americans because the threat environment has changed significantly. So that becomes a bit of a problem for me, and it's not surprising because that's what I thought the government was going to do. For them, it's about the North. And the North is important. Don't misunderstand me. Improving our surveillance detection capabilities in the North for intercept purposes to enhance our North American deterrence posture and our defeat posture, if necessary, is vitally important. But this is the problem with Canada. We think about this in very narrow terms instead of thinking about it in much broader terms in terms of North America.
And how does that affect the relationship with the United States then?
Well, at the end of the day, strangely enough, it doesn't have a great impact on the United States. The United States sits there and waits to see what we're going to do and where we're going to fund and support, and then fills in the blanks. You call them gap fillers for us. So if you, for example, when the question was asked about the maritime approaches in the Pacific and Atlantic and sea launch cruise missiles, either from submarines or surface vessels, the answer we got was, well, the Americans are going to do this. Well, that's insufficient for us. We have to do more than we normally do. But over all the years I've studied NORAD and North American Defense Cooperation, the Americans sort of take what they get and then solve the problem themselves. So I don't think it's going to be a problem in Canada-U.S. North American Defense Cooperation, but we could be doing much more.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good friend for Canada to have. It doesn't make us really a reliable, dependable partner, though, does it?
Well, no, it's, but in some ways we're no different from the other allies in Europe.
Yeah.
We're reliable. The allies in Europe are reliable. We're sort of dependable. But at the end of the day, the Americans have to fill all the gaps, which for whatever political reasons or funding, economic reasons or social reasons, we're not willing to do. And the key problem, I've argued this for many years now, is we have to stop thinking that North American defense and our contribution is simply the Arctic and the Northern approaches. We have to be much more a reliable partner. And I think we need to be a more reliable partner. But the government is still, in many ways, we're still locked into the Cold War.
Well, in the question of threats that, you know, that missiles and missile technology can pose, and I think increasingly that's the worry that, you know, that this technology is advancing, these missiles can reach, you know, further distances. And so we've got this awkward situation where we're cooperating on continental defense, but not on missile defense. So how much of a problem is that?
Well, we heard it from, if you look at what the defense minister said, we're going to keep looking at this issue about ballistic missile defense. Then the chief of the defense staff, if I remember correctly, came out and talked about the Americans are doing integrated air and missile defense. Hypersonics are not ballistic missiles, but they're not cruise missiles. They sort of blur that boundary. This is an issue which the government has to come, basically has to do an about face. And, of course, that's politically problematic for them. If the Americans, and from what I've studied on this, the Americans are integrating air defense and missile defense capabilities, including ballistic missile defense, and that's an important issue for all of North America and for Canada, we have no choice but to start to get on board with this. Now, there are issues involved here. And in terms of if we say we want to participate in all these levels, cruise missiles, advanced cruise missiles, hypersonic vehicles and ballistic missiles, exactly what's the parameters in terms of American thinking about how what we can and cannot do? And that's always been a problem for Canada. So this is a really big issue, and the government doesn't seem to have yet come to get its head around it. I think the military has. Mm-hmm. Certainly NORAD, I believe, has gotten around to it. It says we can't stay out of this.
Right, so all of this that we're investing in, the radar in the north, the sensors in the north, which, as you say, we're a little narrowly focused on the north, but what is it that all of this radar and sensors are to be tracking in the first place?
Well, they're designed primarily, and it's hard to know whether the systems they're talking about, and from my understanding, what they're basically talking about is over-the-horizon backscatter radars, which are radar networks. They're not the big phased array radars that the Americans use for the missile defense program and for their early warning program. It's sort of difficult to know. And if you look at what the defense capabilities that the minister talked about, well, we're going to acquire advanced air-to-air missiles. Well, that's not going to be sufficient for this. What is meant by a layered system? Are they talking about back to the 50s when the Dew Line, the Mid-Canada Line, the Pine Tree Line were developed, three lines of radar? Are we going back to that? We just don't know. I mean, the devil's in the details here. And the government needs to be a lot more clear. And I understand a lot of this is highly classified. top secret, because you can't give this information out in the public domain, but the government needs to be a little more clear, I guess clear is the word, but a little more, I can't think of the right word right now, I'll leave with clear,
yeah.
A little more clear about exactly what all this means and where these lines are going. They're not going to be big radars, as far as I understand, but again, when they talk about long-range radars to the high Arctic, and she said that the technological problems have been solved. I don't know if they have, because you have a lot of problems in terms of radar using backscatter, which bounces off the ionosphere, into the high Arctic, where you have, for example, the Northern Lights, which screw it all up. So whether they've solved that or not, I don't know. But there are a lot of big issues here. That is probably going to cost a lot more than the $4.9 billion that they've assigned to this.
In terms of moving forward, and the minister alluded to, you know, on the question of missile defense, we'll continue looking at this, et cetera. I mean, you know, 2005 was a long time ago. I think the politics of the day and the Krejci and Bush dynamic, that all played into that decision, I think. I think we're far removed from all of that. Why is this still, I mean, this is essentially a political matter still, isn't it?
Well, that's a really good question, because I don't understand it. As the government increasingly has talked about this, and even though in the 2017 defense policy we said we weren't going to participate, there's been no public reaction to it. Even the attentive public, the anti-missile defense public, has not said very much, and they might coming down the road. I don't know, but the government is free to move wherever it wants to go. So all I can figure out is that within the government circles, within the Liberal government, that they have some latent fears about missile defense. But those are all dead. Missile defense is here and now. Everyone's got them. The Russians have them. The Chinese have them. The Indians are developing them. The Americans have sold them to our NATO allies and to the Saudis and others in the Gulf states. We're living in a world of missile defense. We better get up to the modern age. And somehow, I don't know why, it's hard to explain why the government seems to be reluctant to move forward, except on the issue of what does participation mean for us? Exactly how do we deal with this, and what do we get out of it? That's the key political question and strategic question.
Absolutely. Well, we'll leave it there. Professor Ferguson, appreciate the insight. As always, thanks for making some time for us here today.
My pleasure.
All the best. This is Jim Ferguson, Deputy Director of the Center for Defense Studies, Defense and Security Studies, professor in the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba. I remember speaking with him way back then. That's how long both of us have been around. But in the context of everything that was going on at the time, you know, there was a lot of politics in Canada saying to the U.S., we don't want to be a part of missile defense. But it's just, it's untenable that we want one foot in and one foot out when it comes to participating in continental defense and that shared responsibility. Earlier this month, we passed the 100-day mark, 100 days since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And obviously, Russia's lofty ambitions very much came up short in terms of, you know, steamrolling toward Kyiv, the capital falling, and all of this country falling under Russian control. Obviously, that didn't happen, and Ukraine has mounted a very brave and inspirational resistance, a resistance that continues. But certainly, the Russians have not yet been defeated. And more recently, you know, the Russians have been making some advances in the eastern part of the country. So all of this very much hangs in the balance. And it is clearly very much, not just in Ukraine's interest, obviously, but I think in the West's interest, that Ukraine prevail. That Vladimir Putin in particular suffer a defeat here. That Putin not be emboldened to go further. I don't think anybody's under any illusions. We shouldn't be, that this all ends with Ukraine. So can Ukraine still prevail here? What's it going to take for that to happen? Our next guest, a really interesting op-ed in the Globe and Mail today, looking at how the West can help bring about that crucial scenario. Earl Braun is a professor of political science and international relations at the University of Toronto, also an associate with the Davis Center at Harvard University, joins us on the line here this afternoon. Professor Braun, great to have you with us here. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So as you assess the situation as it stands, in terms of where Ukraine is at, the extent to which Russia is succeeding, what's your assessment of where things stand?
At one level, it's absolutely remarkable that Ukraine continues to fight back, that they have not fallen as a result of the massive Russian invasion, and that they are able to resist. They have even taken some territory back. They pushed the Russians back in the north from around the Kyiv area and a good deal of the Kharkiv area. But the conditions are very difficult. The Ukrainians are sustaining vast losses. Their economy has been grievously harmed. And the rest of the world is also suffering because Ukraine was a key provider of food. They were the largest exporter of sunflower oil, vast exports of wheat and barley, and all of those have been impaired. So it is a very tough situation, but I think if we are to move forward, we need to be very honest as to where we in the West have failed.
It's part of the problem that maybe the West is almost losing interest, that this was a big issue, right, at the cusp of the invasion, when the invasion began. But as this has dragged on, maybe, the West has started to put its attention elsewhere.
There is a kind of war fatigue in the West, and opinion polls in various European countries suggest that many would be very happy to have some kind of settlement, which may be a very bad one, actually, for Ukraine, but they believe that somehow this would bring an end to energy supplies, it would lower inflation. And sadly, none of that is likely to happen. That at this point, helping Ukraine is really helping the West. And this is why we need to understand what exactly is at stake. This is not just a charitable act where we are trying to behave in a moral fashion and to help Ukrainian refugees. This is a battle for the post-Cold War Europe. This is a war that is being watched very closely by China. And should Russia prevail, then I think Taiwan would be in danger and many other countries in Southeast Asia. So there's an enormous amount at stake. And in a sense, the West, by helping Ukraine, would be helping itself.
Right. And this doesn't end with Ukraine, does it? I mean, if Putin succeeds, if Putin is victorious in Ukraine, that's a very worrying omen, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this is why I said that we need to understand where we failed, because the West had sent all the wrong signals to Russia. Instead of saying to Russia that the West would do everything to help Ukraine, we kept, particularly the American government, kept saying, these are the steps that we will not take. We will not send troops. We will not send heavy armaments. We will not send anything but defensive weapons. The Germans, before the war started, would not even allow other countries like Estonia to transfer old German guns that they had obtained from Germany years before, because they were so afraid of provoking the Russians. They had become so dependent on Russian energy. The West, by following good intentions to deal with the environment, had driven up energy prices. That had benefited Russia enormously. So Vladimir Putin felt tremendously emboldened in invading by believing that he had a green light, and also because energy prices had climbed so high that he had filled up his coffers. He had the sovereign fund with over $600 billion, and he believed that he would be sanction-proof.
So what does Ukraine need at this point? How does the West need to step up, in your view?
We need to move along the entire spectrum. They need political support. They need economic help. But ultimately, what is most important at the moment is that they need to prevail on the ground. And there, they need heavy weapons. They have to have the artillery. They have to have the longer-range rockets to take out the massive artillery that the Russians are using in a fashion that they had employed in the Second World War, even in the First World War, to just level cities. The Russian government is not restrained by international law
or any sense of international morality. They will target not only Ukrainian soldiers, but civilians, whether it is those who are in hospitals, children who are in schools, opera houses. They do not care. And so there is no choice. And we have to realize that very difficult fact, that there is an incredibly brutal conflict going on. And as much as sanctions are significant, they're not going to do the job. You have to give the Ukrainians the tools. The Ukrainians are willing to fight. They're asking us to provide them with the weapons. They're not telling us that we should fight their war.
What about Canada, though, specifically? I think certainly, you know, the Americans, the Germans, the Brits have the capacity to provide that. Canada's ability to provide those tools is somewhat more limited. Where does Canada fit into that?
We have tried to provide financial help, and we have sent over a few heavy weapons, I believe 4 long-range artillery pieces. We don't have very much, and that is partly because we have drawn our armed forces down to such a very low level. And this has been one of the problems. This is what has emboldened Vladimir Putin. If you look at the Germans, they had so diminished their armed forces that about one-third of their aircraft could not fly. And the Russians took note of this. So the Germans now are busy trying to rearm, and they have committed themselves to spending an extra 100 billion euros on buying armaments and to spend in the future at least 2% of their gross domestic product, which is a NATO goal. We in Canada, though we are trying to help the Ukrainians, we are not helping ourselves sufficiently. Our defense spending is way below the goal that was set by NATO, that all countries should spend a minimum of 2% of their gross domestic product. Russia is spending well over 4%. And even though Russia is only a remnant of the Soviet Union, it has built up massive forces that have not performed that well, but nonetheless have an enormous amount of firepower, which they are using in an indiscriminate fashion against the Ukrainian civilians. So we in Canada also need to help ourselves, and that helps Ukraine. If we can improve our armed forces, if we can increase the number of troops, we can better defend our sovereignty in the north. That would mean that Russia couldn't just divert troops away from the Arctic. They have built up armed forces in the Arctic massively, and there is a concern that some of those troops might be transferred by Vladimir Putin to Ukraine as he's losing very large numbers of troops. So we need to make sure that Russia cannot just switch forces from one area to another and focus on advancing Ukraine, where they are making slow but steady gains in the Donbass.
We'll leave it there for now. Professor Braun, thank you so much for making some time for us here this afternoon.
Thank you for having me on.
Much appreciated. Oral Braun is a professor at the University of Toronto, also an associate of the Davis Center at Harvard University. You can read him in the Globe and Mail today at theglobeandmail.com. He says, with enough support, Ukraine can still defeat Russia, but that we need to provide that support. You often hear stories in the news from time to time about a high-profile criminal case that, for whatever reason, might have a publication ban imposed. And sometimes there's a need for a publication ban, in terms maybe of protecting certain evidence, protecting a victim, those kinds of things. Information that could compromise the case or compromise a victim if publicly disclosed. But there is also the important and what should be the prevailing principle of open courts. The Canadians deserve to know what's happening in a criminal justice system. Just like you could go to the courthouse and sit in and observe a trial. This is all supposed to be done in the open. So publication bans should be rare. Certainly there should be, I think, an onus on, whether it be the prosecution or the defense or even the judge who agrees to it, to justify why it's necessary. And I think Canadians should be concerned if this is becoming more the norm. But how would we know? Where would one go to find stats on how frequently publication bans are imposed? It's not really something we keep track of in Canada. Maybe that's why it makes it easier for the courts to deploy this tool. A new investigation from the National Post reveals that we have seen an increase, a 25% increase over the past 2 years when it comes to the use of publication bans. Joining us to talk more about this special investigation, Justice in the Shadows. You can read more, by the way, at nationalpost.com, is reporter Adrian Humphreys. Adrian, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Rob. Great to be here.
Like I say, we don't have any kind of a central database that tracks how often publication bans are used in this country. So where does one even start in trying to calculate that?
We sure don't. We started this project just with the anecdotally, our reporters in courtrooms across the country thinking, boy, I'm hearing a lot more about pub bans, but, we didn't know one way or the other how they were being used, who were using them, really why. And I thought it would be an easy case of just calling up justice ministries and courthouses and court systems and academics or law profs, and someone surely tracked this. Mm-hmm. But I found that no one really did. And these things, not only is there, it's sort of like a veil of secrecy over a veil of secrecy, right. Things that are being kept secret, but we didn't know how many or how often these things were being kept secret. So I decided, I found a way, I thought, to try and at least give a peek into the use of discretionary publication bans, and we can go and discuss at some point the different types. But the use of these across Canada, and I created my own database here with an assistance from a colleague, and we did get some sense, and at least over the 2 years we were able to study, as you mentioned, our anecdotal information was absolutely backed up by the data that we found.
So we've definitely seen an increase. That much we can now say with certainty.
Yes, and for some provinces, particularly in BC, we were able at the end to get after 6 months of asking the Attorney General to give us some even broader data. And in that broader data, we see quite an alarming increase in discretionary publication bans over the last 10 years. So it's sort of a creeping phenomena that is upon us.
So what is the purpose of a publication ban?
Well, I mean, at its heart, it's to prevent people from knowing something that would otherwise be known.
Right.
So when you hear something in court, or a document filed in court, or an exhibit or evidence is shown in court, the principle is supposed to be that that's public information now. The whole root of courts, in our past history, was that the community would gather and hear the testimony and decide, who's lying and who's not, and this information was to be public. But there are some circumstances, as you noted, when it seems like a good idea for justice to keep some things, at least temporarily, not publicly known. Right. And so it's basically to prevent information from being known, and sometimes that sounds like a good idea, and sometimes it seems like a really horrific idea.
So the examples I'm familiar with, one would be a preliminary trial where a case hasn't yet gone to trial. There's certain things presented in a preliminary hearing that could maybe potentially affect, a jury pool. People will hear certain details that could compromise the trial. Often we see a publication ban. When it comes to protecting victims or protecting children, again, it makes sense then in some of those cases to have a publication ban that applies to those details. Those are the ones we're familiar with. Those are the ones I think the public gets. But increasingly, it seems we're hearing about cases where the publication ban just seems to make no sense at all.
Yeah, and there's different types, as you know. So a lot of those ones you mentioned are mandatory. Some of them are even in law, like a pretrial evidence.
Yeah. A judge doesn't
place a publication ban because there's already a publication ban placed on it by the Criminal Code of Canada. There's other kinds where the judge says, where the law says, if it's asked for, it's automatically granted by a judge. And then the third kind are completely discretionary. And these are the kind that we want to focus on. Obviously, the mandatory or the statutory publication bans isn't really an issue for the same sort of scrutiny. It's what the real scrutiny comes to when judges are having to make a call. And a lot of things come into play on this. One of the main ones that that we were focusing on is nobody often knows that a publication ban is even being asked for. So there's no one there to object. There's no one there to press the judge to put some careful scrutiny. You know, how necessary is this publication ban? Yeah. Is it just to protect someone who has a good lawyer's reputation or name? Is it just a matter of convenience for an accused or for a witness? Or is there a real need, a real public need in the interests of society to impose that pub ban? And increasingly, I think, as there's media resources are less and less, there's less opportunity for challenges to the publication bans. And I think they're being used and perhaps abused by those with positions of good lawyers and good resources and who can ask for and push for more secrecy than they probably should have.
Yeah, and your piece today, I mean, it gives the example of a situation in Newfoundland. There's a trial that's mm-hmm. going to start next spring for a prominent lawyer who was charged with four counts of sexual assault. And for some reason, there was a publication ban placed on the identity of the accused. Now, news organizations became aware this was a high-profile case to begin with, so that was appealed, and eventually that was overturned. But there's an example of a publication ban that seems to only be there in the interest of protecting the accused.
Well, yes. And in fact, although it was overturned, it's still in effect.
Is it really?
Because the judge agreed to allow that prominent lawyer's to appeal to the Supreme Court. Wow. So as of now, we have a trial scheduled for that man, but we cannot say who he is. And it's not a case, some people say, oh, well, it might identify the victim, but it's not a case. If it was a case where it could have identified the victim, then it would be would fall into these other categories of, statutory and mandatory or types of publication bans, and it would be much easy to understand why. But that's not the case in this. The argument in this case is that he is a prominent lawyer, and his credibility and his business might be affected if it is known that he is charged with, sexual assault of a child.
Right.
So, it's a guy with good lawyers and good legal, sense. He's a lawyer, a prominent lawyer himself, perhaps able to get something that perhaps you or I or many of your listeners would not be able to get.
And that's where I think, I don't know if slippery slope is overstating it, but sure, anybody charged with any crime, faces potential harm to their reputation. And ultimately, I think we in the media need to respect the principle, and people in the public need to respect the principle of innocent until proven guilty.
Absolutely.
But this idea that, we have to shield somebody's name because, this could be troubling to the reputation. I mean, that's an argument for putting all of this, the whole system behind closed doors. Obviously, yeah. Open courts, this principle, that means we report on these things.
We do, and it is innocent until proven guilty, and there's a place for that. And I was in my research. I was talking to criminal defense lawyers, and they say, well, I think there should be more publication bans in the sense that, there's an argument we made some of the European systems, for instance, where you don't name the accused before trial. But that's not our system. That's not our law. And the law should apply equally to all. So there's not a sense, from my perspective, perhaps of a guy with good resources and money and great lawyers should have his name protected when, the vast majority of other people don't.
And in a situation like that, someone could still go sit in and watch the trial, couldn't they?
Yeah, but they wouldn't be able to tell anyone about it.
Right, which is weird.
And this is the thing, you can usually say, publication bans, it's a media issue, it's about reporters complaining about how they do their job. But at the heart, it's not. It's not. The reporter gets to know. I can go into the courtroom. I will know the name of that lawyer. It's the public's right to know because the public, by and large, won't be in the courtroom. They're not able to sit in the courtroom. The media is the eyes and the ears of the public.
Yeah.
And so it's not a publication ban on preventing the media from doing something, really. It's really a ban on the public knowing information, often usually important information, about the community they live in and the community around them. And that's what's really at issue here.
Absolutely. Well, some important work, much more is mentioned, nationalpost.com. Adrian, thank you so much for making some time for us here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Rob. I really appreciate your interest in this.
All the best. Veteran reporter Adrian Humphreys with the National Post, nationalpost.com, their special investigation, Justice in the Shadows. Why are we seeing an increased use of publication bans? I think that's an important question. Just even before you get to that point, how difficult it was to even figure out whether this has been used with greater frequency. We don't keep track of all of this. And so much of this goes on, you know, far removed from the view of the public. A lawyer makes a request for a publication ban. Who's there to challenge that? Who's there to be a voice for transparency and openness? In most cases, nobody. You know, this case in Newfoundland is high profile enough that, you know, the media were following it. And at least there was someone there to say, what the hell is this? So it was media organizations that challenged that in court. The order was overturned, but actually remains in place until this lawyer has a chance to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada. Imagine a system where nobody ever knows anything about any of this. High-profile lawyer, or for that matter, even a high-profile politician, can be charged with a crime, can appear in court, and none of this is known by anybody because we can't tell you about it. An interesting new study out today looking at an important question around minor hockey. At what point does it make sense to introduce body checking? You know, at what age are kids ready to have that physical element of the game? Obviously, it's not going away, certainly when it comes to higher levels of hockey. You know, for U18, junior, you know, and certainly into senior and professional hockey, obviously that's a part of the game. And so there are some levels still for more rec play where, you know, there isn't body checking. But, you know, for the most part, in the competitive levels, there is. When does it make sense to introduce it and how? There's been a line of thinking in this debate that it's better to introduce it at a younger age so kids have more time to learn it. And then once they get to those older levels, they'll be better at it. And by extension, then, there would be fewer injuries. But does that hold? So there's a new study today from the University of Calgary looking at that question and finding that it doesn't hold, that quote-unquote experience with body checking doesn't lead to fewer injuries. So joining us to talk a bit more about the findings and the implications, very pleased to welcome the program here this afternoon, Dr. Paul Eliason, lead author of this study, postdoctorate scholar of the Sport Injury Prevention Research Center at the University of Calgary. Dr. Eliason, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
I guess part of the impetus for this study, which was partnership with Hockey Canada, Hockey Alberta, and Hockey Calgary, was kind of to answer that question, wasn't it, about the so-called experience factor?
Yeah, exactly. So that's a really important question that the hockey community is wondering, and that's what they've been asking their hockey associations with. And so they've been pleased to partner with us to work on this and try and provide some scientific evidence to help answer that question.
Now, I know some of these levels, you know, the names have changed, but, you know, previously body checking was introduced at the Pee Wee level, which is now U13. That got moved to the Bantam level, which is now U15. So we can sort of compare then, can't we, the experience?
Yeah, so a few different things here. So like you mentioned, while changing the age when body checking introduced from U13 to U15. So that was supported by evidence as well. It's really strong work led by Dr. Kellen Emery out of U of C as well. And that showed significant reductions in the rates of all injury and concussion when you compared those that played with body checking to those that didn't at the U13 level. And then also more so, we've looked at it at the U15 and U18 age groups in those non-elite levels of play, where some jurisdictions have removed body checking from non-elite levels. And we compare those to similar levels that play with body checking. Once again, we show significant reductions in all injury and concussions. So that's kind of led to what we're studying here is what the whole body checking experience issue. And so this particular study that got published is looking at experience in the under 18 age groups. This is ages 15 through 17. However, we also looked at it in the under 15 group in a previous paper that was published earlier this year.
Okay, so we're looking basically at prevalence of injury, that if the sort of experience theory holds true, then you know, those entering that 15 to 17 age group who had, you know, longer experience with body checking, presumably then we should see fewer injuries. But we don't, do we?
No, exactly. I actually see the exact opposite. When we looked at the rates of injury concussion specifically, because we know that's of concern in youth ice hockey, we actually found that those with more experience, 3 or more years specifically, actually had higher rates, significantly higher rates,
wow,
of all injury, injury that resulted in more than 7 days loss, and concussion compared to those that had less body checking experience.
Do we know why that might be?
Yeah, so we adjusted for many other important covariates in our statistical model that we know might be relevant to injury. So, for instance, the position that they play, and then what age what they were going into for their first or second or third year. And one of the other covariates we adjusted for was whether they played in elite or kind of sub-elite levels. And we think why those with more experience could be having higher rates of injury and concussion could be due to these faster skill and speeds of play on the ice. That actually wouldn't be captured by just kind of elite or sub-elite. So it could be within the gameplay that we're not capturing that.
So what does it tell us about the current status quo, which I think is in place for the, you know, the entire province of Alberta? I'm not sure what it is in other provinces, but the body checking is something that's introduced at what is now the U15 level. So kids going into the U18 category would have had 2 years, I guess, of experience with body checking. What does it tell us about that status quo?
Yeah, so it does. The policy of when body checking should be introduced and what levels of play kind of varies across the country. But, you know, this work that we're providing with our community or with our hockey associations really helps inform them, not only for their recent policy decisions that they've made, but any future ones with regards to when they think body checking should be introduced and what levels of play should be introduced.
Right. And ultimately, I mean, you know, and I think the impetus for this was to better understand the nature of these injuries. You know, it's about keeping the game safe, not necessarily about changing the game, but how do we ensure that it's as safe as it can be, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, this work is helping show that there's no unintended injury consequences that have happened from the body checking policy changes. We know that it's reducing injuries and concussions. And ultimately, this work just helps provide further evidence in support of disallowing body checking in youth ice hockey to help prevent injury, help keep kids safe and playing longer, and that's ultimately what we want.
And when we talk about these kinds of injuries, you know, I mean, is concussion the most common body checking related injury? Because, you know, that's obviously a concern in a lot of sports. Is that, you know, the big concern here?
Yeah, it still is. So in this particular study, concussion was the most common injury type we saw, accounting for about a third of all injuries. We certainly see other injuries, sprains, strains, broken bones, you know, and bruises, of course. But actually, shocking finding actually was prior to the body checking policy change that removed body checking at the under 13 age group. I mean, the rates of concussion were almost similar to the NHL. So it was really important that we focus in on concussion specifically to help prevent those injury types, because we know there's certainly could be some long-term consequences with regards to concussions.
Yeah, I mean, are there factors that have to do with, you know, the varying growth rates, you know, the kids have around that age, that you see a real disparity when it comes to size and weight? Is that something you're able to factor in assessing that?
Yeah, so we were able to examine weight as well as one of our covariates in our model. We actually didn't find that weight was a significant predictor of injury or concussion in this particular study. In some of our previous work, we have shown that weight is relevant, but not in this particular analysis. But you're certainly right. I mean, at these ages, we could see varying sizes of players on the ice as they're growing and developing.
Well, some interesting and important findings. We'll leave it there. Dr. Eliason, thanks so much for making some time for us here today. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much. Take
All care. The best. There you go. So that's Dr. Paul Eliason, lead author of the study, postdoctoral scholar of the Sport Injury Prevention Research Center, University of Calgary. So, you know, spurred on by, you know, these organizing bodies, Hockey Canada, Hockey Alberta, Hockey Calgary, wanting to better understand this. Was it the right decision to remove hockey from what is essentially the Pee Wee level? Or was it a mistake? You know, what can we learn from that experience? You know, kids who are going into U18 or midget, as it used to be called, with, you know, 2 years of body checking experience, maybe versus 3 or 4. And so some interesting findings there, which would seem to vindicate that decision to introduce it at a higher age. And you do have now those options, whether it's U15 or U18, you know, leagues where it's non-checking, you know, because, you know, you're still going to have injuries. Obviously, I think it's important to look at what can be done to reduce injuries, but you're not going to eliminate them altogether.
Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge. And you can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Afternoons with Rob Breckenridge, starting at 12:30 on News Talk 770 Calgary.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.